am very pleased to be able to present this discussion that I had with Vyacheslav Lichachev. It is the type of honest discussion about Ukraine, which is difficult to find outside of research papers and academic lectures. My only regret is that much of the discussion focuses on what amounts to propaganda and misrepresentation of Ukrainian history, people, and current events. I hope to elevate such voices in the future, whether it be about Ukraine or other global communities. However, I believe there is utility in providing this level of expertise and cultural understanding to a Western audience who might be getting their information from Western-dominated social media sources, even those that falsely present as being left-wing, anti-imperialist, or anti-war. I learned about this individual from his research papers regarding Ukraine and was inspired by his anti-hate work and knowledge of Jewish history. I am not Jewish, but I myself have worked with Jewish historical societies in the past. We will touch upon the major propaganda points from Western alt-imperialist and Russian propaganda, including historical Ukrainian nationalism versus the modern Ukrainian state, including OUN, the weakening of far-right elements in Ukraine, propaganda regarding Maidan and the Russian invasion, Yanukovych's presidency, right-wing street crime, the effects of the Russian invasion on Ukrainian far rights, and of course, the Azov Battalion. My hope is that this video will help viewers move beyond this propaganda to seek out authentic Ukrainian voices instead. Please see the description of this video or audio for links to his work.
My name is Vyacheslav Lichachev. Originally, actually, I am from Russia. I graduated from the Jewish University in Moscow, which was a little private university, one of the first ones after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I am a historian according to my educational background. I began to work with the Jewish community as a serviceman in different capacities, the journalist, and very soon after the graduating from the university, I began to work with different human rights NGOs, mostly on issue of related to xenophobia and discrimination. I was involved in the first project on hate speech in Russia. I established together with the college the system of monitoring of violence, hate crimes in Russia. In 2002, I moved to Ukraine for mixed personal and political reasons. From the very beginning, I was not fond of Mr. Vladimir Putin, and I was strongly opposite his politics. In Ukraine, I continue to work with both the Jewish community and the human rights organizations. In Jewish community, my work was mostly related to the cultural issues. We established a museum of Jewish history in Chernivtsi, in a town in the southern western part of Ukraine near the Romanian border in a historical Bukovina province. I tried to work on establishment the Jewish studies in Ukrainian universities. It was mostly of my m most of my efforts was in this I don't know. In general, preservation of the historical, cultural, and spiritual heritage of the Ukrainian Jewry. And I worked for human rights organizations, again, on the issues of hate, monitoring of hate crimes, with the focus on anti-Semitism, but not only. And it really means also monitoring of the far-right activity, because the right extremist groups are mostly responsible for the violence, hate crimes against visible ethnic minorities, against visible different religious minorities like Muslims, and against the representatives of LGBTI community. Together with the monitoring of hate crimes, I began to pay special attention for far-right groups and began this work in Russia, and I continued it in Ukraine. And I am the author of the number of books on Russian and Ukrainian far-right groups. It is a kind of my special scholar or research interest. I lived for several years in Israel as well. I worked in the Yad Vashem Memorial and Museum there. And I returned to Ukraine. I made an Aliyah, so I'm an Israeli citizen. But I returned to Ukraine after the beginning of the Russian aggression in 2014. And began to work with documentation of the violations of the international humanitarian law, which mean war crimes. Because I think it was something personal for me as a person who grew up in Russia and lived in Ukraine for most of my adult life. I feel some responsibility for what is happening. And if I'm not a person on a military service, I try to do my best for justice. I really believe that such cases as war crimes could not related unpunishment in the world after the Second World War. Most of my efforts before the beginning of the large-scale Russian aggression on 21st February this year was in communication with the International Criminal Court, just to push its preliminary investigation about the war crimes from the beginning of the war in 2014. And for last half of the year, my efforts continues to be devoted to documentation of the war crimes and for some humanitarian efforts as well. And one of the organizations I'm proud to belong to, Center for Civil Liberties, received a Nobel Peace Prize last week. So it's where we are now. Thank you.
That's excellent. And that's, I was not aware that I had known that where you had lived. I wasn't aware that you moved back to Ukraine really during or engaged in this conflict. That's really something. You explained why, but very much worthy of admiration, definitely. And you talked about one group. I did see another group, the National Minority Rights Monitoring Group. Is that an organization that you've worked with or maybe just written for?
It's a kind of a small expert group. Actually, there are three or four of us right now. I established this group under the umbrella of the Congress of Ethnic Communities of Ukraine, which is an umbrella structure for 18 national level association of the ethnic minorities, Jewish, Hungarian, Polish, Crimean Tatar, Romanian and so on. And it was a kind of direction of institutionalization of the direction of previous activity, mostly especially on xenophobia and hate crimes monitoring. But during last 2 or 3 years, we were involved also in drafting of a new version of legislation on national minorities, which is established right now, partly because of the efforts on EU integration by the Ukrainian government.
Excellent. And we discussed a little before how some of the topics that I want to touch on are very large, and that each one could be hours if we wanted it to be. So I'll pose them and you answer them in a way that you think is best and appropriate for an audience that might be just being introduced to some of these concepts. And so the first question I had was, in your work, The Right Sector and Others, National Radicals and Ukrainian Political Crisis of Late 2013 and Early 2014, it is stated that the existence of Ukraine in a small way is achieved by some goals from historic Ukrainian nationalists. However, it is in no way a result of their efforts. I think that that's important and maybe something that the audience, you know, needs to understand. So what do you mean when you say that the existence of Ukraine in some ways is an achievement of historical Ukrainian nationalists, but is in no way a result of their efforts?
Sure, I think there is an important concept that it is not clear by default for the Western audience when we talk about nationalism and nation building in Eastern Europe. There is a serious principal difference between nationalism in a states which already have a historical background and tradition as a state, and nationalism of the nations which only struggle for their sovereign independent state. We have some usually or often some negative associations with the concept of nationalism, because we think, well, it's something about this far-right inclusive version of the nation, that's something about hate against foreigners, migrants or ethnic minorities, and it's something about xenophobia, and something like, I don't know, Nazi during the Hitler's times. But really, it's because the reason is that the Eastern European territory was historically divided between three large multi-ethnic empires. The Russian Empire and the Turkish Ottoman Empire and the Habsburgs Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the peoples, different peoples, including Polish, I don't know, Romanian, and they struggled, Serbian, they struggled for their independence against the imperial power, and their nationalism was a nationalism of nations which only try to establish their own country. And the Ukrainian nationalism as a concept, as it was formed, as it was established from the very beginning, from its origins, was a movement for the Ukrainian national state, as every nationalism of the peoples without their own state is, like, I don't know, contemporary Kurdish nationalism or something like this.
Yeah.
And The slogan that you will reach the independence for your country or will die in struggle for it was the first slogan of the historical organization of Ukrainian nationalists, which was the major nationalistic institutional structure 100 years ago, or in mid-war times and during the World War II in this territory, which was the territory of Poland and Soviet Union without any independent Ukraine. The Ukrainian nationalism was really had a radical branch. It had also a moderate branch, but the radical branch was more visible and more famous because of its violence and terroristic activities in mid-war times and because of its controversial relations with the Third Reich during the Second World War, and because of its heroic struggle against the Russian-Soviet occupation after the Second World War. It was the slogan was the official part of kind of decalogue, like 10 testaments for the organization of the Ukrainian nationalists, like the Christian version of it. And for decades or even for a century, this major idea that Ukrainian nationalist means to struggle for the Ukrainian independence was the main credo of the Ukrainian nationalism as it is. And actually, if in the organization of the Ukrainian nationalists after the Bandera's leadership, the idea of the Ukrainian state was like very authoritarian, anti-democratic, like others, Eastern European nationalisms in that period. After some decades, the major mainstream branch of the Ukrainian nationalism became liberal, became pro-democratic, pro-Western, because it was not the core of the idea. The core of the idea was the state. Yes. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the Ukraine as an independent state appears on a political map. And it appears because of the internal processes in the Soviet Union, because of the some relations in the Soviet establishment, and because of the people's movement in Ukraine during so-called perestroika period, people's movement of Ukraine, Narodny Rukh Ukrainy, which was not really the like nationalistic group, which was not associated itself with the organization of the Ukrainian nationalism and its historical or ideological heritage. And in this situation, the Ukrainian nationalists who continue to determine themselves as a nationalist, they became marginal because they had no other major idea for them. Their only idea was to establish the independent state. Well, now you have it. And what is sense to call yourself nationalist in these circumstances? So there are some liberal parties, there are some socialist parties, social democratic parties, and so on. What do you mean when you call yourself nationalists?
Yes.
And for a long period after the Ukrainian independence, Ukrainian nationalism had no answer for this question. And it is one of the reasons why Ukrainian political nationalism and Ukrainian far-right groups were really weak in Ukraine if we compare with the other Eastern European countries. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, after the revolutions in Eastern European countries, in not all of, but in most of countries, far-right groups became an important part of the political landscape.
Yes.
And there was a kind of process of finding new identity after the collapse of the socialistic ideology. That was a period of social economic difficulties after the collapse of the Soviet system and established the market economy. And far-right populism was more or less successful in most of Eastern European countries. In Poland, in Hungary, in Romania, such parties had like 10, 15, or even 20% of voters, when the Ukrainian far-right groups had less than 1% of voters for first 20 years of the Ukrainian independence. And I think the one of the reasons why the Ukrainian nationalist groups were so weak in independent Ukraine in contemporary political Ukrainian history was that they just had no other idea except the Ukrainian independence, the Ukrainian state, and they could not articulate why they are still nationalists and what they can offer to the voter.
It's very insightful. I want to return to that later because I think that there's something, I think that there's a concept in that could people in the United States potentially could relate to with in times of war or in times of high stress and exterior pressures, the seeking of far right, what you call it, nationalism or what have you, tends to gravitate towards the center. And then when those stresses are relieved, it seeks to lose its purpose and utility and goes back to the fringes. I want to discuss that, though, a little bit later when we talk about the Russian invasion, right? But before we do that, I think we need to talk about how did we get to that Russian invasion? And I think many in the West are maybe more familiar with narratives about Maidan, specifically various far-right elements, like you were just describing, maybe right sector, for instance, staging some type of coup or being directly involved in the transition of government at that time, and that now you have some form of far-right, neo-Nazi, anti-Semitic, Russophobia government. However, as you just stated, this did not and currently does not seem to be reflected in electoral successes of these far-right parties. Can you explain that or maybe broaden that discussion?
To continue where we stop in yes. my answer for a previous question, I said that the Ukrainian far-right were not successful during the first 20 years of the Ukrainian independence. The situation was changed several years before the Maidan Revolution, when the Yanukovych Party of Region became part of power. And from one hand, Viktor Yanukovych tried to provide strong pro-Russian geopolitical and cultural politics. And from other hand, he created very quickly and very effectively authoritarian model of governing inside of Ukraine. He imprisoned most important political opponents. He destroyed most serious opponent groups, not only political ones, but also human rights NGOs had not the best times during Yanukovych period, or groups like Majlis of Crimean Tatar Peoples was also under the repressions during the Yanukovych period. And in these circumstances, far-right groups became more popular because they definitely were a strong opposition for the Yanukovych regime. The major far-right group Svoboda, Freedom, which previously had 0.36% of voters on the parliamentary elections or 0.72% of voters in 2012, got more than 10% of voters, 10.44, if I'm not mistaken. And it was not because the Ukrainian society became more nationalistic or more xenophobic. Svoboda definitely was a xenophobic party. Anti-Semitism was important for its ideology and in their public statements, propagandistic materials, and so on. Migrantophobia was important for the party. The voters support this party not because of its xenophobia, but because they definitely were opponents for Viktor Yanukovych. And it is not so clear from the perspective and from outside observers if we return this time 10 years ago, but the Yanukovych regime was effective in infiltration of others' political parties. And actually, a lot of voters were not sure if the Yulia Tymoshenko's party, without Yulia Tymoshenko, she was imprisoned, will be a really opponent. Other political party which pretended to be opposition party created by Arseniy Yatsenyuk and Vitaly Klitschko, they were like neophytes in politics, and nobody was sure what they will stand for, but everyone was sure what will be Svoboda party for. They will be against Yanukovych, they will be against pro-Russian geopolitical shift. So it was a kind of golden period for Ukrainian far right because of the Yanukovych presidency. And far-right activists and far-right groups were a really an active part of the Revolution of Dignity or Euromaidan protests during winter of 2013-2014. But as for me, and it is my major point in a special article which you have mentioned, their role was definitely overestimated for several reasons. The most important is that they were in focus of pro-governmental media, and they were in focus of Russian and pro-Russian media during the Maidan Revolution and sometimes several months after it, because it was very good idea, according to the pro-governmental during the protests and pro-Russian after the victory of the revolution propaganda, to create the image of the Revolution of Dignity as a nationalistic or xenophobic or even neo-Nazi coup d'etat, as a military riot, which was led by radical nationalists. And there are, if we try to estimate the real place of far-right groups in the Maidan Revolution, as an illustration, I can mention two curious details. From the one hand, in Russian media, in March, April of 2014, right after the revolution. Pravi sektor, right sector, one of the far-right groups which appeared on Maidan, was the second political group which was, according to the number of mentioning in media, after the ruling party of Russia, Единая Россия, Unity Russia. So it's for the audience, it means that it's just a second political force, at least at post-Soviet space after the Russians' ruling party. And of course, this discourse was translated not only in internal Russian propaganda, but also among all the channels of Russian propaganda abroad.
Yes.
Different languages and with different agents of influence. I think the whole picture of the scale on the Russian propaganda in the West is more or less clear. And from the other hand, at the end of the revolution, in the end of February, there were about 200 members in Pravi sector in Kyiv. Again, just to compare, according to the estimation we have, we are not sure in real numbers, but it is the estimation we have based on aggregation of different data, about 2 million Ukrainian citizens participated in a streets protests during the Euromaidan revolution. A little bit more were involved in the infrastructure of the support protests, but about 2 million people were in streets and 200 were in Pravi sector. Pravi sector was not the only far-right group in Maidan. There were different other groups, more like some hundreds more, but it was not actually 1% of all the protesters on the streets in Kyiv and other Ukrainian cities. Of course, they were active and they were visible, especially during the violence clashes with the police and not only with the police, because the regime also recruits street gangs to struggle with the people. So far-right groups with core activists, with their soccer hooliganism in background, or with some paramilitary trainings in their background, they were in avant-garde of the military, of the violence clashes on the streets, but definitely they were not the most stronger power inside of different protest groups, and definitely they were leaders of the revolution. So there is which also a stereotype, which is a kind of a conclusion. The stereotype that the Maidan revolution was in a large part a result of efforts of far-right groups is that far-right groups after Maidan and after the beginning of the Russian aggression became extremely strong in Ukraine, have a lot of support in Ukraine, and that the post-Maidan Ukrainian government and Ukrainian society is kind of far right in general, as it is in the whole. Actually, it really sounds logical because the external threat, the real existential threat for the very existence of the country, is a strong factor of radicalization of the society, radicalization of these nationalistic feelings and sentiments. So it sounds logical. Far-right groups from the very beginning of the Russian aggression established several important volunteer military groups struggled on the front line, and they became like heroes for the large part of the Ukrainian society. They reached a kind of social legitimization. Previously, they were streets level marginals. Now they became the defenders of the country and defenders of the
people. I want to
stop
you there. I want to put a pin in that, because that's going to be the next question. And I think that it's going to build a bridge for people, perhaps in the United States, to understand that phenomenon, because it's not a Ukrainian phenomenon, I don't believe. I believe it's a general phenomenon under these circumstances. But before we get to the rise of street violence, right, and paramilitaries with the Russian invasion, it seems as if, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it does seem, going back to the notion that the far right was directly involved with Maidan, not only in protest, but in the formation of the interim government, perhaps, or the government moving forward, that looking at the results of elections in Ukrainian parliaments, that it's not the case. Right sector, Svoboda, these actually in some situations, Svoboda, for instance, might have less representation after Maidan than previous. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is, but with some important dynamics.
Okay.
Really, right after the victory of the Euromaidan revolution,
yes,
and the parliamentary fraction of the far-right Svoboda party was one of the fraction who was involved in a forming of a temporary government.
Yes.
There were several members of government from Svoboda party because they were in a parliament, as I've mentioned, after the elections of 2012, when they had 10% of voters. They were one of the three opposition parties in the parliament. They were involved in formation of the government because the parliament was the only source of legitimate institutional power in the country before the extraordinary presidential elections in May of 2014. Then there was new parliamentary elections, extraordinary as well because of this transition period in October 2014. And after those elections, the new government was formed, and Svoboda party members lost their positions in the government. For half of the year, they really were part of the government, not really influential, not really strong, but technically they were.
Yes.
But what is important is what happens after the revolution and after the beginning of the Russian aggression, because as a result of the parliamentary elections in 2014, Svoboda lost its support. Svoboda lost its fraction. It was not able to pass the electoral barrier. They were successful in some territorial majoritarian areas, but they lost their support more than twice.
Yeah.
Moreover, Svoboda was not the only far-right group in the party list in 2014. The new-born Pravy Sector was also in the list, but even together, Pravy Sector and Svoboda had twice less voters than they had than Svoboda had in 2012, which means that after this extraordinary circumstances of the Yanukovych's pro-Russian regime was not a factor. When Ukraine returned to a normal situation with a weak far-right groups, nationalists became to lose their support. And it was not occasionally, it was a kind of trend, because in 2019, next normal parliamentary elections, they learned their lesson. They have a strong understanding that they could be successful only united. All the far-right groups, Pravy Sektor, Svoboda, and some others like Andrei Beletsky and his Nationalny Korpus, his National Corps,
yes.
Dmytro Yarosh, who was the first leader of Pravy Sektor, they created a united party list. And again, they lost twice if we compare with 2014, and four times if we compare with 2012, which means that they reached their public legitimacy. They became more or less part of the political system as the participants of the war, as the veterans, as the defenders of the country. But they were not, and they are not, attractive for the voters as a political force. The society can pay them respect because of the participation in defending of the country, but the society has no reasons to support them as a political force, because the society has no sympathy for their far-right ideas, and they have no ideological and intellectual capacity to offer something attractive for the society. So it is where we were before the large scale of the Russian aggression this year.
And I think in many countries, you know, this is true, and it sounds like, and please correct me, but it sounds as if perhaps the greatest electoral success came in opposition to Yanukovych. And once Yanukovych was no longer there, there was very little more that these parties had to offer, and they lost seats. And that this is common, I feel like, with reactionary right-wing, bar nationalist types of groups, that when there's a crisis, they can seize upon it and gain legitimacy. But once that crisis is solved, they no longer serve a purpose, and people are generally more or less, you know, disgusted by their other beliefs, and they kind of go back to the corners of society again.
Yes, that's a kind of a pattern. And it doesn't mean that we should underestimate the threat.
Yes.
Because sometimes far-right groups or other extremist groups like Islamist anti-democratic groups in Muslim countries, they could be successful once when the circumstances are good for them. And these elections will be the last one real elections in the country. And Hitler's support, Hitler's success was in a large part because he was a kind of an effective opposition for the communist threat, and a lot of moderate people support Nazi German party because they will neutralize communist and everything will be okay. So we should not underestimate the threat, but the Ukrainian situation was not this type. Not only because far-right groups, even in their best period, had only 10% of voters, which is a lot of in Ukrainian context, but not really something, as we know, if we compare with other elections. Well, last elections in France, when Marine Le Pen in the second round of the presidential elections has 42% of voters. So, and Italy, where the party with direct neo-fascist roots now in government. So, but the Ukrainian case was that the Yanukovych regime, I think we can say it, tried to support far-right Ukrainian nationalistic political party as an to grow up it as an official opponent, because Yanukovych was sure that this political opponent, he definitely will win on the next presidential elections. He will not win definitely with others moderate, liberal, or any kind of even socialist opponents. But if he will create this unnatural model when the radical nationalistic leader, Oleg Tyakhnybok, who was the leader at this time, will be his main opponent on the presidential elections, he definitely will win. And we're not sure that the government paid money for Svoboda Party, but it is possible and there are some evidences. But we're definitely sure on that the Yanukovych government created a system of media support for far-right group, because administration of the president and the party of region really had a control over the most broadcasting company companies in the country.
I was unaware of this.
They really were effective in a control on the media and on the most important political talk shows. The representatives of Svoboda Party, even before the elections of 2012, when they were not in parliament, they had no support or even they were not known among the Ukrainian society. They were in the TV shows 30 times more often than representatives of the major opposition, Yulia Tymoshenko's party.
Yes.
So of course, it was definitely a natural situation when the government supported extremists just to create a kind of technological threat.
Yes.
For the society to win the next elections. It was the Ukrainian case. And even in the situation of the war, even in the situation of the external threat, the nationalistic feelings, I mean, after the 2014, were not strong enough in the Ukrainian society to support the far-right political projects as it was during the Yanukovych period.
And that's where I wanted to move forward with this, because I was not aware of what we were calling external factors that were artificially inflating these parties. But it almost goes to prove a rejection of them further, as after in later parliamentary elections, we see the numbers dwindle in representation, which were not great to begin with. But with this, though, I believe that I read one of the articles that you had shared with me previous, talking about maybe informal street crime and anti-Semitic vandalism and maybe more, street gang style violence. And has there been an increase of that as the official parties and their representation has dwindled, or is that a wash and not really?
It was not so simple. The dynamics of hate crimes was not it was different in different segments. Trying to generalize it, we have data on hate crimes against religious and national visible representatives of the religious and national minorities for last a little bit less than 20 years. We have data on anti-Semitism for more than 20 years, and we have general data of xenophobic hate crimes since 2006. And the maximum of numbers of such crimes, because of different reasons, were in Ukraine in 2007, 2008. So it was a kind of history right now. Because of different reasons, because of social migration dynamics, because of waves of fashion in your subcultures, because of the Russian example, which was extremely important for the Ukrainian far-right subculture, and so on. We have maximum of racist hate crimes in Ukraine like 15 years ago. They were really a bad situation there. We had dozens of violent attacks on the streets per year with some murders, with some intentional hunting safari, as they call it, for people with other color of skin and so on. It was bad, and nothing like this was after the Revolution of Dignity, but actually this trend became earlier. And I
That's
think
interesting.
also there more a more active participation on the far-right street groups in political process after the beginning of the Yanukovych presidency was the important factor as well. The street far-right groups, including this teenager subculture, choose to protest against the police violence, for example, and not to look for some black skins young people on a dark streets late evening. It is there is a kind of a discussion if we should prohibit it every type of political far-right groups because their propaganda is dangerous and could be source of harm and so on. And the other idea is that we should create a channels to make this far-right activity like an appropriate way to give them some space and some opportunity to be who they are, but in frames of the legitimate political process. And in Ukrainian case, the last way became effective if we see the data on hate crimes. And I think this legitimization, I mean, informal social legitimization that far-right groups reached after the Euromaidan revolution also led to the shift to more moderate version of nationalism. I'm not sure that it is really kind of evolution, but even if it is a kind of a mimicry, their rhetoric became more moderate. They even, you know, cleaned up all the old materials which was openly neo-Nazi in their old websites in the internet or social networks, something like this. And they had not allowed themselves something like they said 15 years ago, when they became famous and when they became public persons after the revolution of dignity. So in Ukrainian case, this kind of social legitimization led to a process of shift to moderate version of nationalism, at least if we compare with their previous ideology.
This is
One last comment back to the hate crimes. Yes, there is one segment where the hate crimes became more numerous. It is the violence against LGBTI groups and representatives of this community after the revolution. But I think it is not again because the homophobia became more popular among the society or more important for far-right groups. It is because of the activization of LGBTI rights groups in public space, because of the trend of Euro integration on the country in general, because of the general, I don't know, human rights focus which prevail in Ukraine after the victory of the Euromaidan revolution. And there appears dozens of open LGBTI organizations, spaces, hubs with some public events and so on. And they became targets of far-right violence, actually, which is a dangerous trend, which is kind of a natural situation for the Eastern European countries, and maybe not only for Eastern European countries. So we are here in the context where Poland or Hungary are as well. It also means that the visibility of LGBTI groups became more important part of the diversity of the society. I'm not sure what the trend will be after the end of this war. Avoid from any kind of prognosis, but maybe if we try to imagine the situation that the war will end and we will return to the point where we were before the 24th February this year, this trend could be the trend of far-right violence activity in a mid-term perspective, mostly because of the Euro integration process, and the government announced that they will be a law on single sex partnership, official recognition, and so on. So it will be kind of a focus of the attention on the society on all the issues around LGBT rights, and far-right groups definitely will use it, trying to mobilize support on this issue. And we can see an examples how it works in other Eastern European countries. So this trend became important for far-right group, but in all other spheres, anti-Semitism, migrantophobia, Islamophobia, the far-right activity and hate crimes became much more or less numerous and dangerous as they were.
And with that, I say it's interesting because it seems as if, and this is, of course, everything is general, you know, when we speak, but with Yanukovych, there was a there was an enemy that nationalists could you know put themselves next to, yeah. And now after having some little electoral success, perhaps this new enemy or scapegoat, as you say, however you call it, with Euro integration or perhaps just elevation of this community into the public discussion, could be a new focus too. But I wanted to ask about the role of the Russian aggression and war of 2022 and how that has that played a role in Ukrainian nationalist groups, either informally with violence and street gangs or politically.
Prephrase.
Yes. More simply,
I prefer to begin with 2014. Because it will be a kind of conclusion for previous part. The Russian aggression in 2014 created this situation when the society as a whole in general and far-right groups got this enemy. And it is a real enemy for the state, for the very existence of the Ukrainian independence, for the nation, and all the young men previously in the circle of far-right subcultures with its street violence and so on, they don't need some conspirological paranoid fantasies about Rahova, because they can get real weapon, they had a real enemy, they could participate in a real existential war to feel themselves heroes, to be accepted as a heroes by the society, to enjoy this popularity and support. So it was a kind of win-win situation for everybody. It was, I think, the most important factor why the street violence against minorities became just less attractive for all those guys. Moreover, on a front line, they have met some old members of Chechen resistance who also fight on Ukrainian side against Russian army. And they have met some Muslim Crimean Tatars volunteers from the occupied territory of Crimean Peninsula who also wanted to struggle against the Russian army. They have met Israeli instructors who came voluntarily to train the Ukrainian army because of their good background and because of their roots from Ukraine or whatever. So they can see that Muslims, Jews, Georgians, there were a number of Georgian volunteers since 2014 in Ukrainian army. they are not under mention, or they are not a part of conspirological dog or something like this, but they are brothers in arms. It is a kind of connection which is, I think, the most strongest in this man's world, you know, in the world with this cult of brutality and masculinity, this kind of manner wound. And it also led to less xenophobia and racism in their mind, not only in their public rhetoric, but really in their worldview. It became less important because they have common enemy, Russia and the Russians. So, of course, the level of anti-Russian sentiments became more strong in the Ukrainian society in general, and some violence activity of far-right groups. They were targeted pro-Russian political groups, for example, or some pro-Russian religious communities, some pro-Russian journalists and bloggers, so on. And it was totally supported by the society because it was in frames of this political struggle. It was not estimated as a hate crimes on an ethnic or linguistic background. It was estimated in frames of political existential fight against Russia. And it is the situation which we have now, but in a large scale and with a strong radicalization of views. Well, first of all, the result of this year Russian aggression is that we don't have any far-right political groups in streets or in parliament or in the media, because all of them literally are on front line, and they have some important loss already, some important ideologicalists or some political leaders died in fights with the Russian army. And second, so we even don't understand what the political landscape will be after the end of the war. I don't think that far-right groups will be more strong and more popular again, because now we have such kind of public mobilization around the government, around the president, and the president appears to be a successful leader in such extraordinary circumstances, even for those who were not really trusted him previously. So I think that the political landscape will be totally different, but I'm not sure that the far-right groups will be able to capitalize their participation in the fightings, because everybody has this experience now. All the society was under the shellings, all the a large part of the society was on the front line. There is nothing special in this far-right experience. And of course, this anti-Russian views and sentiments mainstream in the this public informational sphere, in social networks, in public opinion, but what we can do in these circumstances, it's kind of a natural reaction of the society and individual psychological reaction.
I think it's, and I think it's important for folks listening, and something that they could relate to, depending on age, I suppose. But I think first, the idea that I feel like at times where there's a time of war, that's when these groups step up and they gain legitimacy as defenders or patriots or nationalists. It's interesting what you say about how in the situation of Ukraine, everybody is at war, right? And so in a way, it's almost an opposite effect in which people are being forced to fight next to different types of people, and that there's a collective experience within the country that's shared. And as you said, there's no special status for somebody who says, I'm a patriot, I'm a nationalist, I fought. Everybody is fighting, or if they're not fighting, they're directly or indirectly connected to violence from the war. And I find that interesting. With the attention towards Russians, I find it interesting too, looking at opinion polls from like the Kiev International Institute of Sociology, acceptance of Russian and ethnic Russian, Russian speaking people in Ukraine has always been extremely high until you get around 2013. And, you know, this is for obvious reasons. And then it just totally flips in 2022. From an American point of view, I think of American perceptions of maybe Middle Eastern people after 9/11 and how there were attacks against people, sometimes who weren't even from the correct regions, but just looked a certain way, even in major cosmopolitan areas like New York City. But how there was a reactionary force that was not just relegated to the far right. It was something that kind of went through mainstream United States culture of suspicion, aggression, talking about legislation. And so I think in that way, perhaps it could be a method for people to understand what's happening in a time of war, right? And perceptions of the enemy and what that means, you know, socially.
Well, I think you also can remain not only the public situation in the United States after the September 11, but the situation with everyone who looks like natives of Eastern Asia after the Pearl Harbor in 1941.
Sure.
I think they also faced street violence and whatever, just because they had a visible associations with the aggressor who attacked the nation. So it is in Ukraine, it is more complicated because the Russian language is an important language or the main language for everyday communication, not only for ethnic Russians, but for a large percentage of ethnic Ukrainians as well, because of the decades and even centuries of the cultural and linguistic assimilation. But it's something like English language in Ireland, which was not really
this is what I thought
marker of ethnic British people, but was a kind of political marker, whatever language you speak in your everyday life.
Yeah, I won't go down that road, but I did think of that with efforts by groups like Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland. It's a whole different thing, but the idea of recapturing a culture using a native language as opposed to an assimilated or colonial language and what that means. But that's for another time. We have to do the topic that's probably the least attractive. And that topic is that of the Azov Battalion. And, you know, this group is the focus for all Western media. I believe you've said things like that in the past. However much of the attention produces incorrect conclusions filled with misinformation. So everybody knows your background now and you know, your knowledge of this area. What, in your thoughts, are the significance of the Azov Battalion or regiment, or however you want to describe what this group was or what it is?
I'll try to put it in this way. First of all, founders of the Azov, well, first battalion, then regiment, were really persons with the far right background. Mm-hmm. Andrei Bielefsky, who was the first commander and the main founder of Azov, or the leader of open neo-Nazi group. That's true. It's clear for me. I was followed the Bielefsky career since 2006, I think. So I know a lot of his statements and who he is and what he is. So this part is true. What was not in a focus of media and public, not part of the common knowledge, is that the neo-Nazi group around Andrei Bielefsky was not the only root of Azov. There were like three different groups which united and created Azov, and only one was really far-right and neo-Nazi, the Andrei Bielefsky's group. Other one were the group of soccer hooligans, partly also with far-right views, but not all of them, and not in such open political way, definitely. And the third one were the group of Maidan protests called After Maidan.
Mm-hmm.
They were kind of a mobile groups of during the Maidan protests. There were some guys with Jewish ethnic origins and even one Israel citizen in this group. They were the beginning of the Azov Battalion. And after the creation of the Azov Battalion, Andrei Bielefsky and his supporters tried to create this military formation as they founded on ideological background. But after the several first months, they left this model for different reasons. And the most ideologically indoctrinated supporters of Bielefsky even split it from Azov and from his group, called Andrei Bielefsky traitor of the idea, because he decided to become more moderate and so on. He avoided all this neo-Nazi stuff, and it remained on a, for example, formal emblem of Azov or in some symbolic language, but not in the ideology or propagandistic material of the groups since summer of 2014. The second point is that Andrei Bielefsky and other guys who were interested in politics left the regiment very quickly, less than half of the year from the very beginning of the Azov. And they returned to politics. Andrei Bielefsky was elected as a member of parliament. They tried to create different movements, and they have created a national corps political party, at least. But most of the guys with neo-Nazi background were in Azov very short period of time. We have 8 years of Azov existence, and only half of the year Andrei Belevsky and his circle were in Azov. And after the Andrei Belevsky's left the regiment, he tried to remain some influence. He tried to remain some informal links. He was involved in some crowdfunding initiatives for buying some equipment for Azov or for provide medicine service for those fighters who were wounded and so on. And Andrei Belevsky created a little bit intentionally, I guess, situation of misunderstanding, because he tried to remain the brand Azov as the name of his political movement.
Yes.
Azov was something which made him personally famous and successful. Azov was the most important things, the most important thing he has done in his life. So it was important for him to remain it as a kind of his personal political brand. We need to analyze separately what is Andrei Belevsky and his political party as a political group, and what is Azov as a regiment of the National Guard.
Yes,
it is not a kind of situation of symbiosis of political and military branches of the same political force. It is not like Ireland, Sinn Féin in Ireland, because regiment is just a normal regiment in system, in frames of the National Guard, which is under the umbrella of Ministry of Interior, part of the defense system. It is not a kind of autonomic self-government, I don't know, grassroots militia. It's just a part of an army in general. And political party try to remain some informal links. A lot of Ukrainian military units has such kind of a public support for buying some cars or some defense system or drones for intelligence needs or something like this. It is not a unique situation with Azov. Azov, of course, became attractive and famous, but political forces had no real ideological influence on Azov. National Corps remain.
Yes.
This far-right ideology, maybe not neo-Nazi as it was the Andrei Belevsky's ideology before the revolution, but of course they still remain far-right group. But it doesn't mean that Azov Regiment of the National Guard is a kind of far-right military unit. There is no ideological background, there is no ideological indoctrination inside of the regiment during last 8 years. There are soldiers with different ethnic background and religious belief in Azov, including Jews and Muslims. In their public statements, even during the siege of Mariupol, they made some anti-fascist statements because of this propaganda bubble, which the Russian propaganda tries to create around them. But because of this background of the Azov founders. And because of this comprehensive situation with this misunderstanding which Andrei Belevsky created around Azov's branch, the Russian propaganda, which tried to create the image of Azov as a fascist fighters, was and partly remains more or less effective for Western audience as well, because it was important for Russia to show that there are neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine, that they have some influence and power, and the military unit with these symbols became the best gift for Putin's propaganda, because it looks like real background, real justification of all these claims. It is why the Azov issue became such overestimated. The Western media sometimes, especially on the eve of the large scale Russian aggression previously, they became, like, seems like obsessed, really.
Yeah, it's a fetish situation.
Like it was just the most important things to understand what the contemporary Ukraine is. And actually, looking on the facts and not on the stereotypes in the general image, general media image, we can stress that in the activity of the Azov regiment, in its internal, worldview and subculture, there is nothing about neo-Nazism. There is kind of these fighters, warriors, masculine subculture among Azov.
I would like to genuinely say thank you if you've made it to this point. If you have, you are clearly invested in hearing not from ideologues or sensationalized media or conspiracists, but intelligent people in the region who actually know what's happening from firsthand evidence. We had much more to say, but decided to call the discussion for now. Perhaps we'll be able to continue this discussion in the future. I would like to thank Vyacheslav for taking the time to meet with me, and I hope that you all gained insight from the discussion. Like, subscribe, do all the things. It helps visibility, and it helps visibility to the other videos on this channel as well. Thanks.